Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin, working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer tech, you want to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy, and welcome to episode 5 of the Admin Admin Podcast. We're getting there so far. We've covered quite a lot of things so far, and we've got lots to cover in this show, haven't we, as well?
Yes.
Let's get on with it. So what have you been up to this week?
Yep, what have I been up to? I've been working on VMware this week, working on for another customer. They're another VMware environment. They've got two hosts with local storage, but using a thing called HP's VSA, which is like a virtual iSCSI appliance, which is like a virtual machine, so that it basically replicates data between the two hosts. So if one host goes down, the data is on the second host. Yeah, I had a couple of issues this week with a WSUS database issue. I was looking at someone's WSUS to see why their updates weren't working. They've got a kind of a free tier or free sites, and what happens is the main site downloads the updates, and then the other two sites go back to that one WSUS server and gets this update. So you're only pulling it down from one place, and you can from one place you can auto update. You can say auto approve it, and it will approve it to the other two. But when I was trying to go into it, it was saying that it couldn't connect to the server because of .net error. And when you were Googling it, people were saying, oh, you need to check this is all your services are starting. Make sure all your settings are IIS settings. So I checked all three of those. But I had a look, and when it went to look for the SQL database, because the WSUS run has a SQL database in the background, if you're not using a full SQL server, you can use a Windows internal database, which hosts the database, but you can't just go in there and edit it. It's kind of hidden, so you have to download the SQL management tools. So I downloaded the SQL management tools and went in there and connected to it. I'll put in the show notes how you do that. And I could see that when you're in there, the database was suspect. So it looked like it got some corruption, so I had to run a load of repair tools on the database. And when finished repairing the database, the database came alive, restarted all the WSUS servers and the database servers and the IIS servers, and WSUS was working again. So it started to pull down another update. I don't know how long it hasn't been working for, but I think it had been like 6-7 months, and it had auto approve. And so this customer's got about 700 desktops, and I didn't want it to just go and auto-improve and start installing updates at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I cancelled, paused it all again, and told the IT team what I'd done to fix it. And they went in there and disabled it and started manually approving the updates. So that's kind of my week so far. But interestingly, something what came out this week, which I got forwarded by one of my friends, was that there's an issue with running Windows 2003 domain controllers with Windows 2012 R2 domain controllers. There's a bit of a problem that basically when people try to log onto servers or people log on to local machines, log on to any machine which is on the domain, it was saying that their username and password was incorrect. And looks like what's happening is that the computer account's passwords have been reset. So I'll put in the show notes the link to what it's happening, there's no actual fix yet from Microsoft for it, but they have said that they're going to be releasing a hot fix for this. But I was just going to read what happened. So it's saying what's happening. The Kerberos client depends on a salt from the KDC in order to create the AES key on the client side. These AES keys are used to hash the password that users enter on the client and protect it when it transmits over the wire, so it can't be intercepted or decrypted. Yeah, so when it basically sends, when you try and log onto a PC and it sends your password to the server, it doesn't send it in clear text. Axie encrypts it with the computer password so that it knows where it's coming from, a safe place. But when a Windows 2012 RDC is promoted into an environment where Windows 2003 DCs are present, there's a mismatch in the encryption types that are supported on this KDC, which is used for salting. Windows Server 2003 do not support the AES, and the Windows Server 2012 R do not support AES, and Windows 2012 RC do not support DES salting. So it looks like when they introduced Windows 2012 R2DCs, it changes the way it salts it from AES to DES. So, so it looks like what happens is, if to get the workaround apparently for Microsoft is, if you're having the problem, so you come across a PC that's having this problem, it says restart the computer that's experiencing the issue. This recreates the AES key as the client machine or member server reaches out to the KDC for the salt. Usually this fix will fix the issue temporarily. But then it's saying, what's happening is, did you know that when every 30 days the password on a computer changes there, Andy?
It changes when it asks for changes, or
no, so this is not the change. Yes, this is not actually the computer. This is not actually the username password you change yourself, but the actual computer account actually has its own password, and this actually gets changed in the background without you knowing. So every 30 days it will generate a new password. You don't actually get to see this, but it just happens magically in the background.
Okay.
So what it's saying, what you need to do is that you need to generate that password or force that password manually. So what they're saying is, an option is that you there's a PowerShell script you run, and that basically resets, which basically tells you when the password's going to be reset in the next 30 days, and it will then saying, basically it exports it to a CSV file, and then you run another command and it basically resets the password for you. So on those machines in the background, okay. so that it won't. But obviously you have to remember to do that every 30 days. So that's not really good. Also, option two, you can basically tell it to disable that password being changed. So
Okay.
It doesn't. So yeah. So remember, guys, if you've got, yeah, I wouldn't. If you're trying to. If you're going to be introducing any Windows 2012 R2DCs, don't yet until Microsoft fixes bug, or maybe put a 2008 R2 server in there, or 2012 server in there, and then get rid of your 2003 servers. And when you've got all your DCs up to 2012, upgrade it to R2. So yeah, that's an interesting one there. So keep an eye.
Well, that's it. Yeah, that is. I mean, there's an issue that they've addressed, but they haven't got a complete fix for it yet. Is there any kind of idea of when there will be a fix? Or
no, it doesn't say on whenever. They say they're working on it. So okay. I'll put that in the show notes. But I haven't really had time to really research it, what is happening. But it looks like it's like when the password gets reset, I'm guessing it can't authenticate on the domain properly. So I'll put that in the show notes so people can have a read of it and look into that further.
So yeah, there's a couple of workarounds for people. If they've come across it, then there's a few workarounds that could be good, although they seem a bit. One of them seems a bit awkward.
Yeah, it's a bit of a security risk. So
yeah, that's right.
So yeah. What have you been up to, Andy? Then,
well, I suppose the big thing that you've been working on with me is this ongoing VPN saga, which has been talked about on previous episodes. It's come to a conclusion, which is great. So everything is now up and running. So you were looking at it with me the other night, weren't you? First of all, on a previous episode, we explained how we got the VPN connection for site-to-site VPN and via the two Draytech routers. Now, we got that going. The customer themselves were using an ACT database. So the database was held on one machine, on the host, which was in one office. And there was a further two machines located in a remote office that needed to connect back and synchronize the database. So we got there in the end, didn't we? We got the VPN set up. The rest of it turned out to be just settings within ACT, the actual ACT database itself. We had to then tell it that we previously had the remote IP address in the synchronization server settings, because initially it was, to all intents and purposes, on a remote IP address. Now, of course, it's because it's on the same internal network, effectively. It's on a local IP address, which was on 1.60. And it also needed an open port. And I think most ACT databases seem to use 65100 as the port that they use. So we made sure that those ports were open, and we made sure that the remote PCs could all see 1.60, which was the IP address of the host database, and they could also see the host drives, or the shared drives, I should say, of that host machine. To finish off with, I actually was doing a remote session with an ACT engineer, and he remoted in to the machine and just finalized some of the settings on the ACT database itself, and it was all success.
Yeah,
so everyone was made up.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. There was a couple of things, weren't there? There was like it was that we had the first off that the Windows firewall was kind of blocking, because it was on a separate, different subnet this time. By default, the Windows firewall only lets local on the local LAN have access to the file and print share. So we just had to go into the advanced firewall settings and tell it that the remote subnet could access the file and print share. And the other thing, the other thing was, is that obviously because it needed to know, it had to be able to speak to the other machine by its actual host name. But as we were talking last week, because they were on two separate subnets, obviously NetBIOS only broadcast the name of the computers on its local LAN. So obviously when it was like PB-PC, and if you from the remote site, you tried to go backslash MB-PC, we try and ping it, obviously it couldn't see it because it was not on the same network. So what we did was we went into the host file and added that in, and then it was fine. As soon as we did that, it could ping it and we could see it.
That's right. That was on the second machine, wasn't it? That was the what was the firewall on that? BullGuard.
Oh yeah, and then
BullGuard firewall, was it? Yeah.
Yeah. Then we could ping it, but then we couldn't. Then we couldn't obviously branch to it, and we found out that the BullGuard firewall was blocking it, so we had to unblock that, and it was all starting to work. The other thing you said is that wasn't it inside the ACT? Is it was actually pointing to the public IP address of the old router, which wasn't working. Yeah. So as soon as we changed that to the local IP address, it worked fine. So yeah, but glad we got it, and the customer's happy, I'm guessing. So he can access.
Yeah, that's one of those jobs where all the customer wants, and I suppose every customer's like this, aren't they? But all the customer wants is to click that button and it works, and that's all they want to happen. And they don't really care what goes on. And how difficult it is, or how awkward it is to get it going. That's all that they want. We had a few user errors as well, where the customer is himself. We changed it one night, didn't we, to the to the local IP address 1.60. And when he got in the next morning, I'd asked him to try it. And the first thing he looked at was that address and said, oh, that's wrong, that's wrong. So he changed it back again to the external IP address and it wouldn't work. And he was on the phone to me saying, it won't work, it won't work. You know, so I think he was overeager to get it going. And I had to explain to him, no, we've got to change it back to the local address now. That's where it was there. So, but all happy at the end of the day. And still, it's been working ever since we had, when was that? That was, for us, that was 2 days ago, was it? Something like that now?
Yeah.
So it's been working, no problems for 2 days. So I think we'll be fine with that.
Yeah, I think we're going to do another podcast on the VPNs, doing what site-to-site VPNs are, and we can go into that quite detailed. So, but we've actually had our first email question in this week from Jeff, haven't we?
So yeah, no, we've had emails of other people, just saying that, you know, this is a good show, which is brilliant to hear, and giving us some ideas for shows and that show topics. But this is actual question that he wants answering. So, and hopefully we'll be able to give him a good answer. So I'll go ahead and read the question. Okay, so this is from Jeff. So he's just started show number 3. And I'm curious about Exchange. What would you recommend to use for spam filtering? Does Exchange have any built-in spam filtering? Okay, so he goes on to say he's in charge of 6 VMware ESXi servers. It's a 3 Dell 2900s and 3 Dell Rack R520 servers. I would like to hear of some VMware info also. Everything learned from reading the VMware site. It's better than most, but not comprehensive in my opinion. When I got the first Dell server, it came on a skid and weights and weighs 150 pound. Quite a weight, isn't it? Yeah. When I start up the beast, the six fans sound like a jet engine. Now that is impressive. Yeah, they do make a lot of noise, can't they? Just wanted to point out this is an awesome podcast. Interesting and intelligent comments and info from Andy. Well, I don't know which one he's listening to. And the deep stuff from Al. So, many podcasts do not have such good co-hosts that complement each other. Unfortunately, between relocating and some health issues, I've not been able to contribute to my podcasts. On the Podnut server show on Mobile Dynasty. Keep up the good work, gentlemen. And that's from Jeff. So excellent email, and thanks for all the positive feedback. But there's a question in there, and that is about Exchange and spam filtering. So what have you got to say about that?
Well, okay, yeah. So with Exchange from 2007, there was an extra role you could install, which actually has to go on its own separate server called Edge Transport Server, which is normally placed in the DMZ and is not normally part of AD. The problem with this is obviously there's an extra license for this, because you obviously have to pay for another Exchange server. And I think there also might be a kind of a subscription base for that as well, because you get the antivirus scanning in there as well. So that address, that Edge Transporter role, is basically is available in 2007, 2010, and 2013. So there's actually a feature in 2007 onwards. It's not enabled by default, but it is called, I'm thinking this, it's called a spam filter. So what? Yes, basically spam. So to enable it, you have to basically run a PowerShell command, and that enables the anti-spam agent. Okay, If you're running SBS 2008 or 2011, this is enabled by default. And it gives you a number of things. It gives you content filtering. So these are rules which are enabled, which are basically updated by Microsoft, I think on like a 2 week rotation period. And it basically receives the mail and then it scans it and determines by an SCL level, which stands for spam confidence level. And I think depending on what it is, if it's like a, I think if it's like a 6 or a 7, it like deletes it straight away. And if it's something like a 2 or a 3, it basically quarantines it for you. And that it could either then be released by the admin, or I think you can also set it up so it goes into the spam folder on the local in Outlook, so that, you know, like in the spam filter in Outlook, it puts it in there. But also, it does things like IP allow this, so it also lets you looks if you know that certain people are allowed to send, you can put it in there. You can also put block this, so if you see people spamming you, you can put it in there. You can also do sender filtering, so you can basically say, yeah, if this person's on my safe list, these people don't get scanned by the anti-spam, and it basically gets emailed directly into you. So also, I've had it in the past where you can put things like in the content filtering, you can put words for it to block, so it could like, it will like add words up, so if it sees like I don't know, pills or something, or selling Viagra or something, if it sees it a couple of times, it will add it up and it will block it. And I had a couple of years ago, someone was moaning that when they were emailing in, they were basically, certain emails were basically getting deleted on the way out, because I think that will be, so what happens is that it also does it on the emails on the way out. So like if you send an email out, it also checks it so you're not spamming out, so in case you get some sort of bot on your network, it sends out. And they couldn't work out why these emails weren't all going out, and I could see them going into the queue and then being delivered. But the problem with this spam filtering in Exchange 2007, if you need to look at it, it's all in log files, and you have to enable the logging for it to see. And what was happening was that someone had put in the blacklisting word Facebook, and what had happened is they changed their company signature to say facebook.com, so that's the company name. And obviously, when every time it was going, the email was being sent out, it was being selected so that it was spam. So yeah, that was a very long day trying to work out why these emails weren't being sent out.
Well, do you remember in one of the earlier episodes that we did, and you helped me with that outgoing email server?
Yeah.
And it was, we had to change it to an SMT point. That I can't remember all the details off the top of my head, but that was something similar to that, wasn't it? There were the spam filtering within.
Yeah,
that was 2012, wasn't it? That one, that the spam, yes, filtering within 2012 was blocking all sorts of messages going out, forwarded. It was blocking forwarded messages internally, and they had ultimately been put on a blacklist, hadn't they? On some servers. So,
So what you can do is you can put in here the blacklist provider. So you can put in there like you can put in the blacklist people, so it goes off and checks. So when you receive an email, it will check to see if that's on the sender list, and if they're being blacklisted or whatever. And if it's being blacklisted, it won't accept the message. And that's the problem we were having with your people. When they were sending out messages, it was coming from a blacklisted IP address. It's all good and well, this Exchange 2007 or the Exchange spam filtering, but I don't always recommend it, because I don't feel it's that brilliant. I always recommend paying for a service which is somewhere where you host, they scan your messages before they come into your building. So what happens is you point your MX records to someone else. Like the person I use for all of my people is a company called PostLayer, And what you do is you point your AMX records at those IP addresses, what they provide. All the emails goes into that, and it scans it, A1 for antivirus, two, it blocks, it takes off any attachments, and then it obviously then looks at the spam, and then and it identifies spam. And obviously, let's say leave it to the professionals, because that's what I recommend, because that's what they do. That's what they, when they get, when an new outbreak comes, they can see it and then they block it all. And then that, what happens is that when the message is processed and it's all okay, they then forward it to your Exchange server. And what you can do is you can lock your firewall down so that it only accepts emails from that host, from your spam provider. So that means that you're not publicly putting your Exchange server on the internet, and then you're not liable to get spammed. People try and bypass your spam filter, and then people can't try and hack your SMTP server. So I always recommend using a hosted spam provider, really.
That sounds like a much more secure way of doing it. I haven't used one of those. I haven't had the chance to, or no one's asked me to do it at this minute, but that's definitely what I do, is host it externally. I mean, I've tried to mess about with it internally with that spam filtering, as you've been talking about, within Exchange on 2012. And to me, it's a pain, it's a minefield, and you've got to know what you're doing, and you've got to know what's what, haven't you? So you're right, with leaving it up to somebody else, then that makes our job easier at the end of the day, doesn't it? That's up to somebody else.
Also,
It
also means that you can get like weekly spam filtering. You can get a spam or a quarantine email, so then the users can go and release the message themselves. And you can go onto a nice, easy, like the one in Postlay I got. You can go in there and you can see how much emails are coming in and stuff. So I'd always recommend that, because one of my other companies I worked for in the past, this is in the old days, we only had a 2 meg line coming in, and we were like processing, like, because it was like a healthcare company, they're like processing like 10,000 emails an hour, and that was like eating all our bandwidth up, because obviously your Exchange server has got to basically receive those emails. All those emails are coming into your network. So we were like, once we put this spam filter in, we would reduce our email intake into like 1,000 emails an hour rather than 10,000 emails an hour. So that obviously then reduced our bandwidth. And yeah, it's really good. So there's many servers out there. I use PostLayer on my home server. I mean, I only got 5 people on it, and they charge £5 per user per year. So what is that, $25 a year? And I haven't got to worry about my spam filter, and I haven't got to worry about exposing my Exchange server or my email server to the internet. So there's loads out there. I mean, the one we use at work is McAfee. There's some Semantic one. You got the old Google one, the Pacini, until they got overtaken over Google. So, yeah. So answering his question, yes, in Exchange you do get built-in spam filter. It's disabled by default, unless you're running SBS, which is already enabled. So you have to enable it by a PowerShell, and then you can have to restart the hub transporter. And then you can go in there and then configure it. So, but as my recommendation is, use an external.
If you use an external one, would you disable the internal one?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So
well, that sounds good.
So that's hope that's enough information for Jeff. So
yeah.
Right. So what? Having a look at what's happening, I've listened to the Mike Tech Show episode number 514. I want to say a big thanks to Mike for promoting the show and getting some more listeners. I think we've got quite a few listeners out there now. So, but one of his listeners phone in, and it's a question. He says, "I've got a new customer running Windows 2008 SBS server running Exchange 2007, which is running out of space and has no RAID configured. The server has a SQL 2008 installed on it, running a construction database. The server has a WSUS, backup exec, and AV installed. I'm thinking of migrating to a hosted Exchange. Once everybody has been moved to cloud, How do you migrate to the new server? Do you use the migration tools or start the new AD from scratch? So,
okay.
I'd ask what I would do in this situation. This is what I do, basically. This is what I do day in, day out, basically. So, I definitely recommend a new Windows 2012 server. Okay. I would recommend, because with Windows 2012, the licensing has changed. So, with it, if you buy a standard copy of Windows 2012 R2, you're entitled to run two virtual instances of Windows 2012 and one physical copy, which is only meant to be used for management. So I would definitely recommend that you virtualize. So what I'd recommend is get a nice powerful server, something with two processors. So with the Windows 2012 R2 license, the standard license, you can use two processors, okay? You can have a number of cores you want. It's just limited to two physical processors. So what I would recommend you do is either install VMware on that or use Hyper-V and get at least something like 32 gig of RAM in that box. And then I would create two virtual machines, okay? One virtual machine running your DC, so running all your directory services, and that would be doing your file and print sharing. And then create a second VM for the construction database, okay? The reason I like doing this is I like to keep applications separate, okay? In the big corporate world, you should always keep your application separate. So if you have a problem with a server, it's only affecting one application or one product. So if you update something, you're only going to update that one application. If you have an issue with one server, it's only going to be affecting that one server. So what I recommend you do is, I reckon two processors, so get a decent box with two processors in it, decent amount of memory, with RAM in it, with 32 gig of RAM, and then create two virtual machines. And then, because the good thing about virtual machines is it just restarts so quickly these days. Have a problem with a machine, restarts in like under a minute or something. It is so good to run a virtual machine. And again, if you ever have any problems with hardware or you need to get a bigger server in, you haven't got to worry about, all you need to do is shut down the servers, copy the VHD files or the VMDK files to the new server and all the config files, boot it up, and you haven't got to worry about doing any reconfiguring, because that's the horrible old days when you had the older OS installed on the actual hardware, is that you can never really move it well, because obviously different RAID cards and different IDE controllers will always cause a problem.
Yeah, all different, yeah. Yeah, I can see the benefits of that, definitely. I've been messing a little bit out with VM myself, you know, just at the home and everything. And I've got a question about that, though. When you've got 32 gig in the actual physical server, how much RAM do you split over the two virtual machines?
It depends what you're running, really. I mean, I'll probably just give them, if I say 32 gig of RAM, I'll give them 12 gig of RAM each. And so right. that's 24 gig of RAM, isn't it? So that then gives you a little bit of memory for the actual host machine. But so what I'm going to say is that, because he was asking about migration tools, because I know the old horrible way of migrating from 2003 to 2008 was not very good, and there's ways of doing it. And he was saying, well, do I start with this AD with a new AD with scratch? I'd hate to do that, because that means you have to go around all the PCs, disjoin from the domain, then rejoin into the main, copy all the profiles, set everyone's profiles up, okay? And this is a nightmare to do. It's just so much time down for the customer. The customer has to get a new profile. Any issues with their profile, you've got to go around and figure it all out again. It's a nightmare to do. So what I like to do is, I'm going to kind of sort of, what I would do is that with the old 2003 server, you used to have a thing called a transition pack, which basically you install it on the server and it basically converts your SBS server into a full-fledged server. I've only ever done this once and it blue screened halfway through it. So that's a bit of a brown pants moment.
I can imagine.
But luckily it rebooted and carried on doing it. So that's that. But you can't buy that for 2008. So what they recommend is, I've sent you the link I'll put on a link in the show notes. But basically, what you do is that you basically join the new server to the AD domain, and then you migrate all the roles over to the new server, and then you decommission the old server, and then that means you got rid of that Exchange server. But it means everybody is on the same domain still. All the PCs are connected to the same domain. They're all speaking to this, and they haven't, no one's having any profiles because the old domain is still there, all working, but it's now working it on the 2008 or the 2012 R2 domain. So what I thought I'd go through is I'd go through my steps of what I do about how I'd go around migrating and what I do to find out the information. So the first thing I do is take a site visit, okay? I check on the server. I check for what services are running, so make sure to see if there's anything funny, like some applications running on it, some hotel software or some construction software. See if there's any applications running on the desktop, because they might have something like running in the taskbar. So like they might have the server might have to be actually logged in for that application to work. So I record all this down. I take a note of all the shares of what are being shared out, where they're being shared out to. I make sure the server is happy, okay? Run DC Diag, which is kind of a tool which basically checks to see how healthy AD is and if there's any issues. Also, I check the event viewer to see if there's any errors or anything, okay? I then check that all the updates are installed. There's no, if there's new updates installed, make sure they're all installed. Make sure the backup is working, so we've got a full backup if anything goes wrong. I then see in what group policies are set up, okay? And I check what if there's a my document redirection set up. So that basically means what you can do is, using group policy, you can basically tell people's computers to redirect their documents to the server so they're not stored locally on the machine.
That's better to do that, I would say, because it gets backed up then.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it.
And then I check if any printers are shared from the server, because obviously if you go into a new server and they are for the share from the server, normally if it's an old machine, it's obviously like a 32-bit driver. And obviously if you put it on the new server, you always get problems with running 32 and 64 bits on the same server. It's always a bit of a nightmare to get that working with getting 32 and 64-bit drivers working on a 64-bit machine. Okay. I then also check that if certificate services are installed. That's kind of a biggie. If you're going to have to decommission the old server, you can't depromote a server if it's got the CA role installed in it. The easy way to check that is by going to the computer name and going to properties, and it will tell you if that's a domain controller. And if it's greyed out, it says you can't change this server. It says you can't change the name of the server because this is a CA server. So that's another thing to watch out for. So record that down. So what I do is I find all this information out, okay? Then I visit each PC and ask the people what software do they use. So Office, do they use Office and Document? And what other software? So obviously this guy's found out they've got a construction software. Because you always find out that at least if you ask everybody what software they use, you can write it in the document and say, yep, these are the software we're using. And they can't come back to you afterwards and say, oh, yeah, we used the software. Well, you didn't tell me about it.
I've had some of that before.
Yeah.
I have had that where they've told me. They give me a list of things to do, a list of things that they use. And it's only when you've got the new computer running that they say, you know, what about this or what about that? And you think, you didn't tell me about that to begin with. So... But it's a good idea anyway to ask, to find out, see exactly what they've got.
Yeah.
And see if they run locally on the machine as well. Yeah. Some programs will run locally, and some obviously may need a network drive and things like that.
Yeah, that's one thing. I'm trying to work out if they've got anything running on the server. So yeah. I visit
each... Most of them just run it for Facebook then.
Yeah. So then look at what network drives they are mapped and then make a name of that. Where they're my docs are mapped. To because they might be mapped locally, it might be a group policy, but someone might have moved them back locally to the PC, or it might be a laptop. And that's obviously about what they do, what software they've got installed. I also take a name of what the name of the machine is, and I wrote this all down and who the main user is. Okay, once this is all done, I can then obviously work out what needs to be done, okay, what things do. So like this, so if there's any issues in AD, like there might have been, someone might have mucked up the AD server, or it might be that DNS is not working correctly or something, you've got time to fix it. So you can obviously then quote on fixing it, or if you on a retainer, you can then fix it for them. And there might be some downtime.
Yeah, so all that you've done so far, that's finding out what they have previous. And then, at that point then, do you then go back to your office and make a plan?
Yes. So come up with actions, how to make everything working fine. Come up with a plan so we know what applications the customer can sign. Yes, these are the only applications we have. So yeah, make sure everything's up to date. Make sure that you've got a good backup and everything. So the first thing you need to do is so if you're going to migrate to Exchange, obviously migrate into external hosted Exchange. So if it's your Office 365 or ShareWeb, whichever people you're using, the good little product out there called a thing called Migration Wizard. I think they've been overtaken lately because when you go to the website, if you Google Migration Wizard, it's the first one on there. And what that does is you basically, because I know that you, like I was saying the other day, where you export all your emails to PST and then you import it again.
Oh, yes. On the end.
What this service does is you point it at your old Exchange server, your OWA address, and you point it at Office 365 or whatever hosted Exchange server you're going to. And what it does is in the background, it syncs all the mail in the background, calendars, contacts, all in the background. So you haven't got to go to each of the PCs to do it. And
that's good.
Yeah, so then it does it in the background. And then when you flip it over, so you flip the MX records over, you can then then run the wizard again, and does it, you can do that 10 times. So it goes back and it obviously knows what's imported. Anything new comes in, it will then transfer that over to that server. So get them on a host Exchange. When everyone's on Exchange, disable all the services for the Exchange server on that box so that everyone's happy, they're working on Office 365 or whatever, and they know that no mail's going through the old Exchange server. So disable the services, okay?
Okay.
Obviously, right. I would then do, if it has got the CA role installed, you're going to need to do a load more work because I can't really go into it now, but you need to look into it, because basically it could be that they've got certificates pushed out to clients and stuff onto the client PCs, and you could be encrypting it. So that's going to be for another day, but you're going to need to uninstall the certificate service before you can do anything else. So I'd recommend doing that. Then make sure you have a full backup of your server. So if it's like an image, I'd recommend doing like an image-based backup. So if anything majorly goes wrong, you've got a full, you can restore it back to how it was. Also do a backup using the Microsoft backup tool. So you then get a copy of the system state. So if you have any issues and you have to maybe see to Microsoft or anything, you've got that tool so you can back up. You can restore the system state and restore AD to how it was before we made any changes, okay? So when you've done that, okay, you need to prepare the server for the new domain, but you need to upgrade the schema, which is basically telling it what the new parts of the domain you're going to be installing. So that basically updates the schema for the domain and forest. So it's basically you have to put the CD in and you run a command /forest/domain, and that basically upgrades the schema so that you can introduce new domain controllers in. So that's that. And that basically, what you then need to do is join the new, so let's say we're doing 2012 R2. So you need to join that 2012 R2 domain to the server, to the existing domain. And you need to obviously set the DNS setting so that it points to the existing DC server, okay? The old DC. Once you've done that, you can then promote that server into domain, so it basically makes a domain controller. So with 2012, you have to add the role, and then using Server Manager, you promote it to domain. Once you've promoted that to domain, it will ask for a reboot. And that means now you've got two domains in your network, so that when people log onto the domain, they basically either authenticate on your, on the new server or the old server. So that's basically running DNS. Oh yeah, I forgot to say, when you, before you install the domain part, install DNS, because what happens is when you basically install the directory servers and you run, not run DTP promo, but when you promote the server, it goes in and it adds your server into the domain, and then it adds the DNS setting, the DNS server in, so that that will then actually host the domain records for your internal domain. Does that all make sense there, Andy?
Yeah, and I'm saying what you're saying. I've got one question then. Your original domain name would be one thing, and then when you introduce the new server, would that have a different name?
No. So let's say the old server is called server1.domain.local. So domain.local okay. is your domain name, and all your PCs will be pc1domain.local. That's all the PC. Yeah. So we okay. would introduce. So first of all, let's say we're going to call this server DC1, the new server. So we basically join DC1 to the server. Sorry, the DC1 server to the domain.local domain. So you add that, like, you know when you add a PC to the domain?
Yeah.
You just basically add the server in at the same time. You add the server. And that, yeah, so you're not changing the domain name. The domain name keeps the same. That's the whole point. We're keeping it all the same as the main domain name. So you don't have to make about anything about rejoining domain PCs or disjoining from the domain, recreating user accounts, etc. So what I so once you've promoted it and done that, what you need to do is make sure AD's happy. Run DC Dir again on both machines. Look at the event view. Make sure everything's happy. Then, if DHCP is installed on the server, I forgot to mention that earlier, you need to transfer that over to the new server.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Or that might
be. Well, we've got a whole show on that, haven't we?
Yeah. So there's a load of commands out there which you can basically back up the DHCP database and then restore it on the other server. Obviously, then you need to change the DNS settings so that the primary DNS server is a new IP address of the new server and not the old one. So you put the first one as the primary and the second one as the old server. If you've got any local static IP addresses on any machines, you obviously need to go there and change that around so that the new one is the first IP address of the new server and the second one, the secondary, is the old server. I mean, if the DHCP server is set up on the router or something, you need to change it on there as well.
Okay.
And what you need to do is that when you install DC Promo, the server, I keep saying that, but when you promote the server, you need to, after reboot, you need to change the DNS settings on the local new server, because it's actually pointing to the DNS servers, are pointing to the old server. So when it does DNS query, it's not actually looking at itself. So you need to change that to its local IP address.
Okay. Yeah.
So that means you now got working. So if people can log on, that's all fine. So you now need to start moving data across. So the first thing you need to move is, obviously, there's two ways to doing this. Is that you can either do it in a big bang style. So one weekend, you could use RoboCopy to copy the data across from one server to the other. Because the problem is, if you just copy the files from one server to the other, let's say like you got a company share and you copy it from one server to the other, it won't copy the permissions across.
So I've got to say, I was thinking of that. As soon as you said that, I thought permissions.
Yeah.
You're going to put them on the new server and no one's going to have access to them.
So what you can do is you can run RoboCopy, okay? And there's a command you can do on that, and it will basically copy the permissions as well. So you won't have to worry about that. Obviously, we could use a thing called DFS, which is Distributed File Server, or System, sorry. And what that does is it's like a... it's part of the domain, and it's a way of, it synchronizes files in the background, so when something changes on one server, it replicates it to the other. And there's another a funky thing about DFS is the actual domain name. So you know, like, you can go /\ computer name / servant or the share name, you can actually go /\ the domain name .local / and then you can create a share on there. So you, what happens is it like there's a referral thing, so you can say that if you've got a multi-site thing, you can say backslash domain.local / company share, and that means that you're not actually pointing it to one computer name, you're actually pointing it in the back end to two servers. Okay, so you can flip things over. So what you could do is you convert it to a DFS server, and then you'd never have this issue what you're going to have now, because obviously now we changed the company share. So before it was like backslash server / company, and now it's going to be backslash DC01 / company, isn't it? So you're going to have to go round and either rename, you have to go in and obviously repoint everyone's map drives to that new server. Obviously you can do that through group policy, but once you obviously use DFS, you never have to worry about it again, because it's always pointing to this DFS share name and not the name of the server. So yeah, so once you moved over the company share, obviously then you have to go around and go through and obviously update people's group policy to redirect, if they've got logon script, change it so that obviously maps to the new share. Then obviously my docs, if they've got redirected my docs, you're going to need to copy them across again and obviously update the group policy to tell it that the group policy redirect documents are now on this server to the on the old server, from the old server to the new server. Okay, so once I've done all that, I always disable the shares on the old server so that people can't access the old servers. So even if they've got a shortcut and they try and click on the shortcut, they obviously can't get to the file. If they phone up saying, or they say, oh Al, I can't access this file, you can go to them and you can say, oh yeah, you've got a shortcut to the UNC path and not the the map network drive,
the new one. So good idea to disable the old one, otherwise you could end up with duplicates and different versions and things like that.
So if you've got any printers, obviously transfer the printers across for your servers or make them locally. So that should be everything. So next thing is I'm saying about creating a second server. So we copied the file and print and everything across. Let's move on to the second server. So he's saying about he's got a construction database and it uses SQL. Okay. Make sure you've got that SQL license, because you might not have the permission to copy that. If it's a SQL license with SQL with SPS 2008 and you buy the Premier Edition, which you get a copy of SQL, I don't think you've got the license agreement to copy that across. If it's a SQL Express, it's fine. But as I was saying earlier, that I like to have a separate service, is that I always like to, problems like that, I like to give it to the people who look after the software. So they obviously, if they've got this piece of software and they're paying maintenance for it, get them to do the work. I don't like getting involved because it's finger pointing. So all I did is set up a server, set them up with a user account on domain, which only got admin rights to that PC, and then you give them the software. They can store in SQL how they want it. They can set the backup plans. They can dial on it to themselves, and then they can transfer the software or the databases across, and then they haven't got to muck about with your SPS server anymore, your domain controller. So that's what I would normally do. So once they meet all the SQLs across, I would definitely tell them to disable the SQL services on the old server, and it means that there's no chance of them SQL server being enabled and accessing the wrong database. Okay.
So
we've done everything. So I think so now you should have everything off the old server. Okay. So we're running on the same domain. We've had to go around. No one's had to go and have a new profile. No one's had any major issues to their PC. You've recorded everything down before. So if anyone has got any funny network drives which aren't being mapped by group policy or anything, you can go through there and go to OpenShield and change them manually. Okay. So the next thing I'd do is that obviously check there's no services open. Check there's no shares left on that machine. Make sure there's no open files left on it. All the open files you see is the net logon share, okay, because it's sort of the main controller. If they're happy that everything's working on the new server, I would go and do a full backup again, and I'd decommission I'll start the exchange service and decommission the exchange, okay? Because you don't want to just go and pull the plug on that server and then just go and turn it off and don't do any cleanup work, because you're going to leave AD in a horrible state, because it's going to be trying to communicate with the old exchange, the old DC server, because you need to, if you're going to decommission your DC, you need to do it properly, okay? You need to remote it. And also the same with Exchange, because Exchange needs loads of attributes in AD. So remove Exchange, because obviously we had the services disabled for a week or two, whatever you're doing the migration. So re-enable it, decommission Exchange, uninstall it, okay? Because you can now reboot this server all the time because no one's logging onto it. Because the other one, you set the AD DNS settings to this primary server, everyone's hitting that first for your DNS requests, okay, and your AD. And because it's running AD, and if you shut down an AD server, it will always authenticate on the one which server's up, okay? So what I would then do is that after Exchange is decommissioned, you need to set up the NTP, the time server, on that new DC. So, because what happens is that whatever is your FSM, not the FSM role, but whatever is your PDC role on your server, in your domain, that has to be your time source. So you basically tell that to get servers from an external time source, then all your local servers and PCs will go to that server to get its time, okay? So there's a number of articles on the web. We'll probably cover it in another show. Once that's done, and you're happy that everything's working, you need to transfer the FSMS roles to the new server. Okay, the people on were saying that if you promote a server which is running SBS, hang on a second, I've been talking too much. The server will shut down after 7 or 21 days. Okay. If it's SBS 2003 you're migrating from, there's a hot fix you can install. By default, it will start rebooting after 7 days. If you install a hot fix, it will give you 21 days. 2008 and above, it's set 21 days, okay? So if you've got to do a long migration, okay, which you can only do certain things at certain times, this will only start happening when you transfer the FSMO roles to the new server, okay? So this is what you need to do. So the FSS roles are the flexible single master operations. There's four roles you need to transfer, okay? And I'm just bringing them up because I can never remember what they are off the top of my head. You get the PCD emulator, is one I was telling you a minute ago, the RID master, the domain name, and the scheme master. All four of them need to be transferred across, okay? So transfer them across, okay? And once you transfer, you then got this 21-day grace period before the SBS server will start to shut itself down. So by now, you should have everything migrated across. So what I would do is that once that's all replicated, I would shut that 2003 or 2008 server off. Because we're not going to have any problems, because the primary DNS server is your new server. And I said before, if one of the DCs down, it will always authenticate on the one that's not down. So shut it off, leave it for a week, and then see if anyone gets any errors. And if anyone's not moaning anything about it, I'd bring that server back up again, and then you would run DC promo on again to demote that PC from the domain. And then you successfully migrated everything to the new server, because keeping the existing domain, there's been none of the older disjoining PCs from the domain, and then joining them onto the new domain. So,
and that, folks, is all you have to do.
Yeah, in a nutshell.
apart from that, that's all you have to do. Yeah. What is, though, you know, going on this, what is, I know it can vary depending on, I don't know, how big it is, how much data, number of PCs and things like that, but what's the time scale from first being asked or needing to do this upgrade to the final demotion of the old server at the end of it. How long would it take?
I normally do it over a couple of weekends, or normally takes it's only 2 to 3 weeks. I would do it. So like, I would do it, or let's say 2 weeks. So, or 3 weeks. Like the first week, I'd go in there and kind of look at everything. Then, if anything needs to be done to fix it, you probably have to do it in an evening or a weekend or anything. And then that's done. And then, obviously, you can do all the things, maybe even the backup and everything. But we might have to wait for a full backup, so you might have to do that at the weekend. So adding the domain, the PC server to the domain, can be done any time. You haven't got to do that out of hours or anything, because you're not interrupting anything on the network. And then maybe moving the documents at one weekend, and then moving all the docs at one weekend, and you can use the company docs at one weekend. And obviously, then you have to need to rein time to the companies, the construction SQL database. So I'd probably leave 2 to 3 weeks to do it if you're doing it properly, and then without less time. Because the way I see it is that we normally quote 2 weeks to do this, I'd say, because the way I do it, I like to prep it. It's not much. If you do the prep for it, the customer knows what he's going to get out of it. Because if you just jump in there and go, right, I'm going to join this domain with no research, you're going to miss something. And the customer's not going to be happy, because then you're going to be trying to work out why this application is not working, or why this network's not working, or this printer's not working, etc.
Good preparation. Just a bit of a plan, isn't it, really, as well? You know, there's a plan between when you're going to do things in normal working hours, what and when you're going to do other things, out of hours, weekends, depends how long they'll take, things like that. Because ultimately, as well, you want to keep all the people that work in these offices on these machines and have to do the job, you want to keep them up and running as often as possible, don't you?
Yeah, you
don't
hopefully.
Want to, yeah. You know, they don't want any downtime. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be some downtime where they can't do anything, but keep that to a minimum. So the client, the bosses are going to be as happy as they can, because their workers are working all day and keeping their downtime to a minimum. So
it also means the customer's got a perspective of when things are going to happen, so you know when the downtime is going to be, and the customer knows, like I said, do your research, they know what software. And I've told you about documents we work with at work, so that they have to sign it to say, yeah, this is the only applications we know of. So they can't come and say when you're halfway through, oh yeah, well, I forgot about this application, and it takes you 2 extra days to do it. You can then say, well, it wasn't in the proposal.
Well, yeah, and also as well, if you do have to have, you know, all the workers, all the desktops, the workstations down for any period of time, then you know, try and plan that in and let them know when it will be, you know, to give them a chance to get them to do something else or something. You know, maybe they'll come in one Monday morning, and you know, you can tell them when they come in Monday morning, the computers won't be on. You know, they'll be ready about 10. As long as they know, that'll keep them happy.
Yeah.
But what you don't want to do as well is just all of a sudden switch them off and everyone's screaming because something's gone off in the middle of the day. I mean, apart from giving you more work, you know, it's made the customer, the bosses, unhappy as well. So.
Yeah.
So good planning is the big thing for that, I would say.
Yeah, so I think we're just about there for the episode then. So hope that helps the guy out I don't think we mentioned what his name was, so on that Mike Tech show. But again, thanks Mike Tech for promoting this show. So next episode, I think we're going to do DNS part 2, because there's a couple of things I missed out and I want to go over on that. So again, if anybody's got any more questions they want to email us in, I'm happy to answer them. Always like to help things out. I've been darling helping you, so I'd always like to help you out. So you want to get hold of us, you can email us at mail@adminpodcast.co.uk. So really enjoyed the show tonight, guys.
Yeah, it's been a good one. Yeah, learned a lot of that. I'm sure everyone else has learned a lot of that. If you do have any emails or questions like that one, then send it in and we'll do our best to answer it. So So I'll just give you an email address. You can also get andy@adminadminpodcast.co.uk, and yours,
Al,
which is Al as adminadminpodcast.co.uk. So yeah, that's great. So we will see you next time.
Bye for now.
Bye now.